So actually, we are going to consider the symmetries of this action, which we derived yesterday. And actually, to start, I'm going to reconsider for you guys basically the Noether theorems, because supposedly it's 100 years of Noether theorems, and to make clear what is the difference between global and local symmetries. And actually, already from this analysis, one can see the appearance of constraints at some point. And so we consider an action general action, and that will be depend on a Lagrangian density, and that will depend on some fields, phi alpha, and some the derivatives, first derivatives of these fields, phi alpha. And if you assume that there's a symmetry, that means that there's a variation of the fields. Such that the action remains invariant. And actually here, and consider a special case later, if you consider what are these variations. I consider symmetries which only consist in varying the fields. Actually, so I exclude actually anything which where you also transform the variables, coordinates, the space time coordinates, just for simplicity. So that you have to figure out at some point for yourself what happens if you also allow change of space-time coordinates. And so if you use these variations, if you vary the action with respect to the symmetries, it's supposed to give you zero, which in general can mean that actually there might be still a let's see here, a divergence term. So this divergence term usually is not considered, but there are some special cases of symmetries where you have to consider these. and then we just vary the action along the usual rules. And so let's do that. This term then you have this term which is the derivative with respect to the field derivatives and so as is usually you would do a partial integration of this term. And if you do this integration by parts, oops, there's a plus that this was, you will actually get again a total divergence. Okay. So that's just the usual things what one writes to also derive the Euler-Lagrange equations, and this term we basically can call the Euler-Lagrange term. It's the one which has to be zero if the equation of motion are satisfied. So these are basically the equation of motion, and so we conclude if we put everything on one side, me try to put everything on that. This has to be zero, plus there's this term which is L alpha ds phi alpha dn x. Okay. And so actually, if you in case that, let's say there are two cases basically now that you can consider. So one is a global symmetry, and that means that the symmetry you consider, which is global, means that it is par that you have a, you can parameterize it with some parameter epsilon. Oh, I just wanted times something which is an index here, and this term might depend on the fields, of course. And so this parameter is constant, so it's not space-time dependent. And the other case is a local symmetry. So that is what we call a gauge symmetry. And so in this case, it can actually happen. I mean, then local symmetry means that for such a symmetry, you have a choice that can choose a field of these parameters epsilon of x. And in particular, you can choose this field so that it vanishes outside a compact region. And if you have this thing, then you should allow also for derivatives of this field to appear. And in general, it could be arbitrary high derivatives, but the claim is that the interesting cases are all covered by this example. And so to remember that B alpha, I mean, and C alpha mu, so these are all objects which are, could be functionals of the fields. I mean, functions of the fields usually. So it's not that local functions of the fields. And here in this case, you can choose such that the variation only happens in a compact region. So actually, here you can consider the case that lambda is equal to zero. Here, in some cases, it might appear that there is a non-vanishing lambda. And in particular, if this case happens, you can choose arbitrary epsilon. Then you can be sure that you can omit these integrals. And actually, these identities are known as, in this case, are the generalized Bianchi identities. And you can guess why they're called generalized Bianchi identities. So they hold off-shell, which means that here they're still, I don't assume vanishing equation of motion because this term is still there. And in particular, in some cases, you really get the Bianchi identities. So you see that the generalized Bianchi identities, they are just really mathematical identities which actually ensure that the thing, which, I mean, that the symmetry is a symmetry or leaves the action invariant. And apparently that is Noether's second theorem. And so let's go back to the case that we have a global symmetry. So it's the same epsilon here. So in this case, epsilon is a constant, and we can throw it away. And so let's assume global symmetry. Or in other words, epsilon is constant. And furthermore, that the equation of motion are satisfied. So this term vanishes.
In the second case, in the gauge?
In the gauge case?
Yeah.
So here, so it's basically that we had, I mean, here I wrote only this term. You know, actually most, one has to be careful, which not many texts are, because mostly it's about boundary terms, and nobody discusses this really. So we allowed this kind of divergence to appear. d mu lambda mu, which is multiplied with an epsilon. If I have a local symmetry, it means that I can choose epsilon. So that is non-vanishing only in a very small region. So, and then I can basically apply, I mean, then basically this part will always vanish if the integration region is bigger than this region where epsilon vanishes, because this is a boundary term there. It's a total divergence, so it's only a boundary term. So if you make epsilon kind of vanishing at the boundary, then this is always zero. So with lambda for these kind of symmetries, for gauge symmetry, there is no such term. Okay. And actually, usually even, or often this term is not even considered for global symmetries. So this epsilon is constant. the equations of motion are satisfied. And so we conclude that basically this term has to vanish separately. And we can define g mu to be the term inside the brackets. And for this variation, I put B alpha. And I throw away the epsilon, which is a constant. So I have, this is my definition of currents. Okay, I'll continue here. And so then this says that the integral over the divergence of the currents vanishes. And now, basically, if I choose, I left out this integration region. So if I choose this region to be uh, T1, I mean, time interval times any choice of spatial manifold, this statement corresponds to the statement that if I define this charge, to be the integral over the zero component of my current, then this charge is preserved in time. Because then it would just be a boundary term, this boundary, if I make sure that either this is compact or I specify boundary terms so there are no boundary terms from the spatial boundary. So I have only boundaries at the time on the two equal time boundaries. Then this means that basically Q1, which is Q at time two, at time one, is equal to Q2. And so Q dot is zero. Okay, so that is the thing which you should know quite well, because that's the usual case of global symmetries, that for each local symmetry, you have a charge which is conserved in time. And now let's go back to our local symmetries. And so in this case, we have that epsilon. So let's go back to our local symmetries. Let's also assume that the equation of motion are satisfied. So this term we don't need to care about. I said lambda is zero, so we don't need to care about the lambda term. And furthermore, epsilon can be chosen arbitrarily. So that means that I actually even don't need to care about this integration. And so if the equation of motion are satisfied, I have that this term is zero. And now I have this variation. I put the formula for the variation. I put here. Do I call it mu alpha, alpha mu? So this is zero. And again, epsilon can be arbitrarily, so actually I can do a kind of derivative expansion in epsilon, and then I can conclude that each term on any power of, or each coefficient in this derivative expansion vanishes. so if I do that, I first get something which is proportional to just epsilon, and that happens if this derivative acts only on these two terms. Then I have something which will be proportional to d mu epsilon. And so that will basically be the other term from here. That has to be understood this way. And there's this term. So here, sorry. No, this is still in new. This is a new, and this is a new. So to not to repeat indices too many times. So then I have another term with the first derivative of epsilon, which comes from here. So delta mu acts still on these things, and I have basically d nu epsilon here. And there's a last term, which is the second derivative in epsilon. It's always the same term here. Okay, so it's a bit lengthy, but basically we can conclude that all these lines have to vanish separately. And let me try to oh, it doesn't work. Cannot do multitasking. And so let's look at these equations. So actually, we assume that the equations of motion hold. So actually, what these equations could mean is that they are just some rewritings of the equations of motions. So then, and indeed, they are, but it already tells us something about the type of equation of motions we will encounter. And the first one is that this has to vanish. And what we actually are looking for is that you know, the equation of motions, the type of equations of motions you usually encountered in, say, an initial value problem, they were of a specific type. I mean, typically what happens, you know, in physics is that we prescribe initial values, which very often are just the fields and the first time derivatives of the fields and arbitrary spatial derivatives of these fields. And then equations of motion for typical systems come in a form that you have second time derivatives and then some right hand side. Here is some expression which does not include any second time derivatives. And that allows you to solve the initial value problem, and actually that gives you also local, like local uniqueness and existence for these partial derivatives, that you can always conclude what, I mean, that these equations prescribe you the second time derivatives given first time derivatives and all kind of spatial derivatives. And say that first, yeah, that already follows from these things. And so here, what one expects if you take the variation of your Lagrangian density with respect to the derivative of the field, which includes the time derivative, and you have another time derivative. So this equation actually, it seems to be of this form. So this includes the second time derivative. I mean, the only case that the second time derivative is not there could be if B alpha is zero. And then you wouldn't have a second time derivative. And it would only involve first derivatives of time. And actually, that would be a constraint on your initial data. So in this special case, it would be already a here we would be have a first example of a constraint on your initial data, because they would only include first time derivatives and the fields themselves. And so this happens only if B alpha is zero, or if the Lagrangian is quite special. So the second term, I have to rename some indices, says that this thing plus, let's call that mu, then the other is mu. Says that this is zero. So here we would only expect, in this term, we would only expect first order time derivatives. and in this term, there could be again second time derivatives, depending on whether C alpha mu is zero or not. So constraints might be also coming from this, depending on the structures. And the last term is that this thing, something, one of them should be nu. And now one needs to be careful. One contracts this term with something which is always symmetric. So actually, one needs to symmetrize this thing. So this has obviously no time derivatives at all. And so we'll basically, if C alpha nu is non-vanishing, it will be always zero. And in case that C alpha mu is vanishing, then actually you don't get the time derivatives from this term. And this will be kind of a constraint. And so basically, in fact, using this argument, there has to be always a constraint on these kind of initial data with a gauge symmetry. And so it's actually that basically the equations of motion do not allow to solve for all second time derivatives. But in fact, there will be a part of the equations of motion which include no second time derivatives, and so will be constraints on the initial data. And on the other hand, it also follows that not all fields will be uniquely determined, because if you count the equations of motion, and some are not interpretable as evolution equations, so then you miss some of the evolution equations, and you don't have uniqueness. But that's exactly what we understand under gauge symmetries, that basically there are many solutions which correspond to the same initial data. So basically, you already have now encountered constraints, and they already follow from this Lagrangian analysis. And soon we will basically see that explicitly in the Hamiltonian analysis. The same phenomenon, but you see that it's not something which is mysterious, even in the Lagrangian formalism. Okay, so let's go back to our first order, or if there's no questions. Okay, so let's go back to our first order 3D action, gravity action. And let's consider what kind of gauge symmetries we have there. And so basically so that will be loop gauge symmetries. We already mentioned the symmetries we expect many times. And the first one, which we mentioned a lot of times, were internal rotations. We'll change the co-trials. And so they come just from infinitesimal rotations of my co-triad. Infinitesimal rotations, you might remember, mean that in 3D you get the Levi-Civita tensor, or just this epsilon tensor, which is kind of the Lie algebra element. If you take a derivative of this, that's rotation again, and LE are parameters for this rotation. So a rotation matrix infinitesimally will be given by this little epsilon. The epsilon symbol and this parameter, which is basically the infinitesimal angle, lambda k. And that's what is happening if you rotate the triads. And the other thing which changes is, of course, if you change the triads, then the spin connection, if you see that as a function of the triads, will also change. And so you can take this equation and for the spin connection in terms of the triads and derive what happens with the spin connection. And so you will find that the spin connection has a form which you also know from gauge theories. So there will be a term which is a derivative in lambda. Sorry, that is an M. That is an N. And there will be a term which will be proportional to just to omega. And this, if you check, is actually the covariant derivative with respect to omega of lambda, which actually has also this internal index, so that you have to apply the covariant derivative rule to lambda, and that gives you this extra term. Yeah?
Your L index is free on the
Yeah, indeed. So one, yeah. Why do I have an L here? So that's correct. Yeah. Okay, and in fact, you can check explicitly, but it's just the fact that we have written the action. We have contracted all internal indices and used always the covariant derivative. And one reason why we introduced the covariant derivative is to be consistent with respect to these gauge transformations, that in fact the first order action is invariant under these rotations. Okay. And the other symmetry you expect is, of course, diffeomorphisms, because it's about gravity. And so, how do fields change under diffeomorphisms? And I hope that Roos at least has discussed the Lie derivative. Which apparently I also write with a curly L here, which goes, it's defined along a vector field V. So V will be your infinitesimal, will parameterize your infinitesimal diffeomorphism. And then the rule is that the change of any object is given as the Lie derivative in this direction applied to this object, and the Lie derivative basically doesn't see the internal index, completely blind to it. So you just apply the rules which hold for a Lie derivative with respect to the spacetime tensors. And so here you have actually one form. And in the case of a one form, we don't have exactly the commutator, but a plus sign here. And this is the spin connection. On the other hand, it's also a one form. And so you have exactly the same rule. Oh, sorry, now I'm confused. Okay. And so what we did to get the first order action was to rewrite our Einstein action, where you were, I hope at some point maybe checked that it's invariant under diffeomorphisms. and so this first order derivative will be also invariant under diffeomorphisms. And basically I need actually the transformation rules for these fields because we will encounter these transformations later on. And so that's why I list them here. And so that's the two symmetries we expect to hold. However, surprisingly, there's a funny third symmetry. It which is called translation symmetry. And so let me define this translation symmetry. So it stands with this T, it comes with a parameter nj. So it's also with a vector with respect to the internal indices. And it's called translation because it shifts only the triad variables. And so it's defined to be just the covariant derivative of this internal vector object, which was defined to be this thing, this spin connection. And in fact, the definition of the symmetry is such that the spin connection does not change. Okay. And you can check that indeed the action is invariant. Under this change, and basically if you look, and you see why, now one reason why the generalized Bianchi identities are called generalized Bianchi identity, so the action was on a form of the form E times F. so F will not change. E will change by a term which is a derivative, the covariant derivative. So one does integration by parts, and it will basically act on F. And the covariant derivative acting on F is vanishing, and this is exactly the Bianchi identity, which I have never proven, but which actually holds, which you are supposed to convince yourself at some point. And here you see actually that would be indeed the, this Bianchi identity would be exactly the generalized Bianchi identity with respect to these gate symmetries. So now we are a bit puzzled because there's translation symmetry in addition to internal rotations and diffeomorphisms. And it's more than we expect. But in fact, what happens is that these symmetries are not independent of each other, but you can only connect these symmetries on shell. That means if the equations of motion hold. And so in fact, playing around with all these expressions for these symmetries so it's basically relations among symmetry generators. So So these are equations you can basically now sit down and verify for yourself. Is a combination of rotations and translations gives you the diffeomorphisms modulo terms in the equation of motion. And so here you have the torsion tensor. And here you need basically these prescriptors, which depend on the space-time diffeomorphisms prescriptor, which is this vector field V. So this is something with an internal index, the spin connection contracted with this vector, nu, V nu, and E V is a triad contracted with this vector, co-triad. And so that holds for the, you can put these formulas together, that holds for the triads. And as you might guess, so here we have the same formula basically for the spin connection. And then the other equation of motion appears, which is that the curvature has to vanish. So you can, you also see now an example which is not discussed very often. So if you take a combination of these symmetries, so basically dr plus dt minus this diffeomorphism, in general, it will be something non-trivial, the non-trivial transformation of your fields. However, it will be trivial on shell. So it's an example of a trivial symmetry. So of course, it can happen. You know, one should be careful. that the symmetry generators exactly vanish on the points where the equation of motion hold. I mean, they have to vanish, basically. this gives you trivial symmetries. Okay, so it turns out that basically, in fact, 3D gravity is, in a sense, so simple. Because in fact, one can replace the diffeomorphisms with the translation symmetry. And the translation symmetry is kind of much simpler to handle than the diffeomorphisms, as we will see. And so in fact, the constraints corresponding to the translation symmetry will be very simple. I don't know if you, it's easy to see. Will be actually really that f is equal to 0, whereas the constraints corresponding to diffeomorphisms, you would have actually to go to this formula. and you see if you put, if you want to reach a diffeomorphism, you would have to find the V which corresponds to EV. Or if you have, if you want to represent a diffeomorphism V, then you have to use a prescriptor for the translation, which is EV. So actually, it would mean that you would have to take something and contract your equation, which something which is a function in E. And so you, here you get a constraint, which is just an F equal to 0. Here would get something which involves the E's. So in general, this will still be kind of equivalent in the case that the E's are non-vanishing. Then these define you the same equations. But of course, there's always this issue that it could be vanishing. So on singular matrix, this defines a different, slightly different constraint manifolds. However, you also see that f equal to 0 is, something which is just homogeneous in one type of variables, whereas e times f is something where you would have to worry about operator orderings and so on, and it's much harder to solve. And in fact, this is what we would have in 4D, and in 3D we actually can use this formulation, whereas in 4D, obviously, this would be much too strong as a condition. And so, in fact, imposing this translation symmetry is, will be much simpler than using diffeomorphisms. And it will also give us a much simpler algebra because it turns out to be abelian, whereas diffeomorphisms satisfy a rather complicated algebra. Okay. So I think next time we will go to the constraint analysis. Actually, maybe one thing I could also tell you, and you can read all the details in the script, which I will send you tomorrow. So if there's no lengthy question. So we are using this first order action, which I told you at some point is actually BF action. But in fact, rewriting this the gravity into first order action, what we end up with is exactly the same variables one would use in first order Young-Mills. And so in the thing I'm just telling you is that Px minus. This is actually something, this is a first order Young-Mills action. There's even a square root of g here. And there's no square root of g because this is, again, the density. And you can check that this is reduces to the usual Young-Mills action by solving for b and putting the solution into this action. And so you will find the usual FF term. And C2 will be, I have a formula here. Yeah. C2 will be, in fact, proportional to the Young-Mills coupling. So if you choose B mu j to be equal to E mu g, this is the first, this is our gravity action. And you see that the gravity action is actually the zero coupling limit of Young-Mills. That's a bit confusing because the zero coupling limit of Young-Mills is supposed to be something like a free theory. And in fact, what happens, one has to be careful how one scales the fields. And some people, and actually it depends. Some people write actually the coupling. Into there's anti-symmetric derivatives here, but then they sometimes write something like this. So they write it into this action, into the curvature, and some people write it just rescale A by the coupling, and you have it just in front of the action. That's what I use. I don't put the coupling into the expression of curvature. And so, in fact, if you take this other limit, then what you get is not a free theory, but this term which describes your topological field theory. And on a lattice, for lattice QCD, it's in fact the case that one version of taking the limit there to zero coupling will in fact give you BF theory and will give you the same result as lattice gravity. Which means that, you know, physics is unified, of course, no. That you don't learn something completely alien, but it's just, in effect, a much more complicated version of Young-Mills theory for 4D and a much simpler version than Young-Mills theory in 3D. Okay, so thank you. And tomorrow we'll go to Hamiltonian analysis.